from her. We all do. Look, I filed my talk with them just before we took off. Your lot can pick it up from the website.
Listen to her, I hear Louise mutter to her neighbour, mimicking my voice. Your lot can pick it up from the website. Who does she think she is?
Look, it's the middle of the night, I say, trying to get things back on track. Everyone's tired and on edge. We should all get some sleep. Where are you all staying? Mick grabs my hand as I move off, and I squeeze back. He gets up and follows me to the dividing curtain.
When we land, try and get off as quickly as you can, Mick. I'll go ahead with the O'Connors and the Shaws and meet you at the scene. I'll get some photos and video on my phone in the meantime. Ring me when you're on the way, and try to lose Louise. She'll turn us over soon as look at us.
Mick grins.
She's toast.
Right. And Mick? Don't say that in front of the families.
Chapter 17. Tuesday the 19th of August, 2014. The Reporter. The embassy official gives me a long-suffering look when Leslie introduces me.
Ah, Her Majesty's Press. I'm sure you can arrange your own transport, Miss Waters.
She's coming with us, Leslie says. We can squash up.
I say nothing. I don't need to. Leslie's doing superbly on her own. Malcolm keeps quiet, and the Shaws simply look away.
Well, if you're sure,
the official says, displeasure in every clipped syllable.
This way.
The mood of the group has dipped back to numb when Vice Consul Clive Barnes meets us at arrivals.
It was a multi-occupancy building, and the police would like you to take part in the identification process, so there are no mistakes,
he says carefully. I take the lead as the others stumble along in my wake, pulling their suitcases behind them. I need to make a friend of Clive.
This must be the most difficult part of the job, I say, trying and failing to match his stride, coping with other people's tragedies.
Indeed, but I expect you know all about that, Miss Waters. I cannot say I'm happy about taking you to the scene, but it is what the families want, apparently.
This is going to be hard work. I fall back in step with Leslie and gently take the handle of her case from her.
You look worn out. Let me have that for a bit.
Her husband trudges at the back of the group, head lowered, weighed down with another case and carrier bags. Mike Shaw has his bag and Jenny's hold-all. She let him haul it off the luggage carousel for her after pointing it out, but had made no attempt to take it from him. She walks just behind Leslie, but the two women barely speak to each other. Leslie holds her husband's hand as Clive Barnes's driver loads suitcases into the boot of the waiting people carrier. She looks frozen despite the heat, shivering, her teeth chattering. It's all too real now, I think. Not just on Facebook. They are here, and their daughter is probably dead. Malcolm helps Leslie into the car, and I perch between her and Jenny, apologising as I fight to fasten the difficult middle seatbelt. The husbands sit in the row in front. Leslie and Jenny stare out of their windows at the traffic, while the men try awkwardly to make conversation.
I've booked you into a hotel close to the embassy, Clive Barnes says. I'll take you there after you've identified.
There is a beat of silence. He can't bring himself to say the word bodies, and no one in the vehicle is about to help him. Finally, Malcolm says,
Is it definitely Alex and Rosie they found?
And I feel Leslie stiffen beside me.
We can't be sure at this juncture, but it has been confirmed that it is two young Western women who match the descriptions of your daughters.
I stroke Leslie's arm, and she leans into me and begins to sob. Jenny turns her head away. Malcolm is trying to carry on.
We want to talk to the police straight away and go to the scene of the fire.
Clive Barnes sounds grateful.
Yes, of course. One of my colleagues spoke to the detective in charge earlier. The post-mortem examination is later this morning, and the police are still searching the fire site. It might be advisable to have an interpreter for when I'm not available. Shall I help arrange one? What will that cost?
Mike Shaw mutters.
Yes, please, Mr. Barnes,
Malcolm says.
Please call me Clive.
Leslie is still sobbing against me in the back.
Oh, love,
Malcolm says, twisting round and reaching for her hand.
Try to hold on.
The car stops at a barrier across a narrow alley. Beyond, I can see policemen in grey uniforms with masks over their mouths, and workmen with heavy machinery. And Don Richards.
It's probably best not to talk to the press,
Clive Barnes says, then checks himself.
Sorry, Miss Waters. It's our standard advice.
I see. Of course, the press may well help put pressure on the authorities to find out what happened here. I tried to keep my voice even.
Yes, well, shall we get out?
The parents walk together, and I see both Leslie and Jenny slip their hands into Malcolm's as they reach the police guard at the barrier. Mike is two paces behind. Don Richards steps forward immediately.
Mr. and Mrs. O'Connor. Mr. and Mrs. Shaw.
They look up expectantly. Hello, Don, I say.
My dear girl, there you are.
I can hear the disappointment in his voice. I've beaten him to it.
Oh, God. Please let it not be her,
Leslie whispers, as she and the others are ushered through. I go to follow, but Clive stops me with a look.
Families only. Police instructions.
Shit. I tried to catch Leslie's eye to appeal for her help, but they are oblivious to everything, apart from the blackened skeleton of a building. What remains of the guest house leans into the street like an old drunk, vomiting the last of its debris. The floors look as if they have all collapsed. A charred foam mattress is curled in the street, and ash eddies round their feet. The stench of smoke and soot catches in my throat as I call after them.
I'll wait here for you.
I don't know if Leslie's heard, but I take out my phone to film them making their way towards the ruin. I squat down on the curb in the dust and heat to type my story on my smartphone. I need to get the copy sent straight away and be ready before the families come back. I use my thumbs to type quotes and a description of the scene, while Don Richards tries to read over my shoulder. Bugger off, Don, I say when he pretends to snatch my phone. Do your own colour.
Doing it now, matey.
He scribbles in his tatty notebook, standing beside me.
I'll send it on my laptop in a minute. I'm on order for everyone,
he says, thrusting his book back in his pocket.
Here they come. That was quick.
I press send and stagger to my feet to film their return. They look like a funeral procession as they walk slowly back, heads down. Malcolm's arm round his wife's shoulders, holding her up.
How are you doing, Leslie?
I say quietly, as the group draws level.
It's heartbreaking, Kate. Have you seen it?
I step round the nearest police officer and look through a gap in the barrier at the pile of stuff swept up. It's hard to see clearly, but I think I can spot the blackened frame of a backpack. Or maybe it's the twisted frame of a bed.
I can't see anything of Alex's,
Leslie says.
That's a good sign. Isn't it?
I nod. What are the police saying? Clive Barnes clears his throat loudly.
I think we should head for the police headquarters, and then the hotel. You must be exhausted.
We're not sleeping until we've done everything we can,
Malcolm says.
We need to talk to the police. Come on, Leslie.
Mike Shaw nods and tries to take his ex-wife's hand. She almost lets him, her defences at zero. But something still stops her, and she bats him away.
Jenny,
I hear him hiss.
For Christ's sake, this is about Rosie, not us.
Her expression starts to crumble.
This wouldn't have happened if you hadn't given her the money to come.
I hear Leslie gasp and try not to catch her eye as Mike Shaw stalks off to the waiting vehicle.
Let him go,
Jenny says, as Malcolm moves to go after him.
Walking away is what he does best.
Be quiet, Jenny, Leslie says. This is awful enough without you torturing Mike.
Jenny starts to cry again, and Malcolm leads her off. Leslie catches hold of my arm as she passes.
Don't put any of that in the paper, will you? They're both so upset. It makes people say terrible things.
Chapter 18. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The Reporter. Don takes me to one of dozens of cafes nearby to wait for Mick, and we try to talk over the distorted din of the Eagles' greatest hits. Why haven't they got identities yet? I stir my green tea leaves into submission. Have they got the proper equipment? Can they do DNA here?
Of course they can. This is an international hub, not a third world country. But foreign travellers are not a priority. They get hundreds of tourist deaths a year, drownings and traffic accidents mainly, and the cops see them as a royal pain in the arse. They get them off their books as fast as they can. Death and mayhem is bad for the holiday business.
A sunburnt boy in a vest at the next table is obviously listening, practically falling off his chair to catch our words. Hello, I say, unable to ignore him any longer. Are you staying in one of these death traps? He smiles an I'm-off-my-face smile and waves his arms about a bit. Are you? Were you here when the fire started? He nods.
I was walking back to mine and saw the smoke and shit.
Did you know anyone who was staying there? The boy laughs nervously.
No. Most people here don't know who's in the next bed most nights, let alone in another hostel.
I turn back to Don and shrug. Hopeless.
He's right. Some of these places cram kids in everywhere, and the owner of this place has gone AWOL. No surprise, really. The whole area is a death trap. Look at those wires.
I gaze up at the ropes of tangled cables strung from building to building.
They're always shorting out. And there's rubbish and old gas bottles everywhere. The girls didn't stand a chance if they were inside.
Where the hell is Mick? I yell, startling the pothead next to us. We're losing time. I ring his number and take a sip of the bitter liquid. Where are you? I shout down the phone. Don't know where that is. How long? Okay, we're in the cafe at the top of the alley. If you're not here in five, I'm going. Don raises a questioning eyebrow. I need to talk to the possible survivor, I say. It's the only exclusive line I've got. Nervous energy is burning a hole in my stomach. These first hours on the ground make or break a story. I've got to be first everywhere, and I wonder where Louise is now, reporter paranoia kicking in. She's probably sitting beside the survivor, holding his hand and getting the whole story. She's paid Don to keep me here.
We can't see him, Don says. Not yet. I went first thing this morning, but it was a no-go. My bloke will tip me the wink when I can.
I see a taxi pull up, and Mick gets out, already apologising. I stand, and the intensifying heat of the day makes me sway.
Fucking airport security. Someone must have fingered me. Both me and the bloke from the BBC got pulled in to be searched. Our money's on Louise.
Where is she now? I ask. And the others?
The police headquarters. That's where the families are going, apparently. There's talk of a press conference being sorted out later. George will ring me when he hears. I said we'd give him a line in return.
Okay. We'll get it from the wires if they say anything there. Leslie said she'll talk to me at the hotel in a couple of hours, so we've got a bit of time. We need to get to the hospital before the pack hear about the possible survivor.
Survivor?
Mick says. I'll tell you in the taxi. I throw my bag into the boot and jump into the front seat beside the bewildered driver. Get in, Don. We need you to translate. And ask him to crank up the air conditioning. I'm dying here. As we drive, I brief Mick and ring the news desk to make sure my copy has arrived. I want to talk to Terry, but I've lost track of time. They're 6 hours behind in London, and the graveyard shift is still running the desk through the night. The has-beens and old beans. It'll be potluck who I get.
Hello, old lag's home.
Gordon Willis, the paper's former crime man, growls.
Oh, it's you. Just been reading your stuff, Kate. All very moving, if you like that kind of thing.
Sod off, Gordon. It's an exclusive chat. Anyway, What are you doing on the desk? Can't believe they've let you back in the building. You're supposed to be retired and living on the Costa del Crime with all those villains you've written about. What happened? Spent all your redundo on sangria?
I fancied a bit of a break from the hacienda. And they asked nicely. Have you seen Don yet?
He sat in the back of our speeding vehicle, actually. I'll pass your best wishes on.
Do. Where are you going next?
The hospital, to try to see a possible survivor. A lab with Burns, who turned up on the night of the fire. We've got the story to ourselves at the moment. Tell Terry when he wakes up, and say that I'm seeing the parents later, on my own, that the girl's formal ID is expected today, and the police are saying nothing.
Okay. I'll get him to call you when I hear from him. Won't be for an hour or so, unless you want me to wake him now.
No, best not. Look, we're arriving. Speak later.
Chapter 19. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The Mother. Leslie focused on her surroundings. The room was lit by fluorescent tubes set into the ceiling. The floor was tiled with cream and black speckled squares. The tall lockers were stainless steel. And the smell was indescribable. It took her several minutes before she could bring herself to look at the trolley. There was a white sheet covering the body, except for a foot with lime-green painted toenails exposed. "Mrs. O'Connor," someone was saying beside her. "Clive, are you ready?" She wasn't. How could anybody be ready for this? Malcolm took her hand. His felt so cold, like stone. "Yes," she said, because there was nothing else to say. The sheet was peeled back by a mortuary assistant to reveal a waxen effigy of her daughter. Malcolm's hand convulsed in hers. She wanted to reach out and touch her child's face, to comfort her. But the assistant anticipated the movement and stopped her. "Please don't touch the body," a police officer, an austere man who stood to one side, said. "Alex," Leslie corrected. "Please don't touch Alex." "Can you confirm that this is your daughter, Alexandra O'Connor?" he continued, as if she hadn't spoken. "Was," she said. "It's not her anymore, is it?" The officer looked confused. "This is our daughter," Malcolm said. She wanted to stay, but Malcolm led her out to the waiting area, where Jenny and Mike Shaw sat in silence. Leslie didn't need to speak. Jenny's face crumpled at the sight of them, and Malcolm took her hand. "It's Alex, Jenny. Do you want me to come in with you?" Mike Shaw got up stiffly. "No, it's okay. We can manage." His ex-wife stood at his side as the door was opened, and they were ushered in. While Leslie waited, listening to the echoes of misery in the adjoining room, she played with the idea that none of this had really happened, that she would wake up in a minute and be looking at the old alarm clock and hearing her youngest in the shower, using all the hot water. Mike and Jenny reappeared, and she was back in the room. "I was just thinking, perhaps it was a dream," she said. "No, love, I'm afraid it isn't," her husband murmured. "We need to try to think straight now. Now that we know for sure." Leslie looked at Jenny's face, blank with shock. "I wanted to touch Alex," she said, "but they wouldn't let me." "I thought it wasn't her for a second," Jenny said. "The girl on the table had a little rosebud tattoo on her shoulder. I was about to say it wasn't Rosie, but it was. I didn't know she had a tattoo. I tried to kiss her, but they said I couldn't, that there will be time for that later. But they won't, will there? No more kisses. The last time was at the airport." "How has this happened?" Leslie sobbed. "We need to find out why they died like this." "We will, love," Malcolm said. Clive stepped forward. "Let's go and talk to the police." The police colonel at the Crime Suppression Unit was formal but courteous. He was accompanied by the hired interpreter, a young man in a tight suit, Harry Potter glasses and a ridiculous schoolboy quiff. When they were seated, the senior officer immediately outlined the facts as he saw them. "The victims were found together at the rear of the building," the interpreter said, after listening and making notes, his words harsh after the musical lilt of the colonel's account. "But their room was on the top floor," Leslie said. Alex said so in an email. She joked about it being the penthouse. Not in a room, in a sort of cupboard. The interpreter looked flustered. A cupboard? Leslie said. The interpreter asked the colonel a question and nodded obsequiously before turning back to his audience. Bigger than a cupboard, a place for storing things, cold things. The young man tried to explain, but the colonel had started to speak again, and his tide of words was flowing away from the interpreter, who lowered his gaze and started taking notes again. There was a party on the ground floor, he explained when the colonel next paused for breath. He said more than that, Leslie challenged him. It went on for ages. Why aren't you telling us everything, he said. I am, madam, the interpreter said, clearly stung that his professionalism was being questioned. I was about to continue. Good, Leslie said. There were drugs and alcohol taken at the party. Our girls didn't take drugs, Jenny said loudly. Why is he saying this? Her words were not translated back to the colonel. The police think maybe a candle was knocked over at the party, he continued, or a cigarette was not extinguished. Most probably an accident. Did Rosie smoke? Mike asked. No, Jenny muttered. The fire spread very quickly through the rooms. The front of the building was mainly wood. The two girls were hiding from the fire in the cold store. They died from... The young man searched for the right words, putting his hands to his throat to indicate choking. I think he means smoke inhalation, Clive Barnes whispered quickly, to end the pantomime before it became too graphic. And heart attack, the interpreter added. Leslie thought she saw Barnes roll his eyes. The owner of the hostel is being sought in connection with safety violations. And with that, the colonel closed his file, raised his hands in the Y, and gave a slight head bow as he made to leave. Malcolm struggled to replicate the gesture. But Leslie jumped to her feet to stop his departure. Did no one hear them? They must have been screaming for help. The colonel remained standing and impassive. The colonel says no one knew they were there until the bodies were found, the interpreter said. No one heard or saw anything? What about the others at the party? Mike asked. Where are they? What do they say about what happened? How did they escape and our girls didn't? The colonel looked impatient at the question. We have not found any witnesses. So you're saying that our daughters were the only ones in the guest house at the time of the fire? Where are all the other guests? You can't have a party with just two of you, can you? The colonel shrugged delicately. We have not found any witnesses, he repeated. We heard there was a young man with burns at the hospital, Leslie said, remembering her conversation with Kate. He is not relevant to the inquiry. What does he mean? Leslie asked the interpreter. The colonel remained stony-faced as he rattled out a longer explanation. He says the young man at the hospital could not tell them anything, the interpreter said. We are not even sure he was at the guest house. The colonel shook hands limply with them all. We will release the bodies in the coming days, he said as a parting shot. We will give you the documentation and you can take them home. Afterwards, Clive Barnes escorted them to the people carrier again. You didn't look very happy in there, Clive, Leslie said. I don't think Harry Potter was telling us everything that policeman said. Barnes looked pained. My tie is not fluent, but he definitely skipped over some parts. What did he leave out? That the police had been to the guest house previously in connection with drugs. Let's say it was known to the authorities. There was a little more detail about how the girls were found. They did not suffer any burns or injuries. They must have died of smoke inhalation. The storeroom they were in was metal, which would have kept out the flames, and they had wrapped themselves in some matting to protect themselves. Oh, God! Leslie had an image of her frightened child hiding from the flames. Why are they saying there was a party if there are no witnesses? Jenny added. Barnes shook his head. Perhaps the others have made themselves scarce because they don't want to be questioned about drugs by the Thai police, he said carefully. Our girls didn't take drugs, Jenny repeated. Barnes paused. We don't always know what our children get up to when we're not there, do we? Do you think that's why the boy in the hospital didn't say anything?
He must know something if he was there, Leslie said. The police should be questioning him again.
Bangkok, day 11. Wednesday, the 6th of August, 2014. From Alex O'Connor. To Max Harding. Subject, Rosie is a complete nightmare. Hi, Mags. It's been a mare of a day. First, R decided she was definitely going to get a tattoo. She begged me to go and hold her hand. I told her it was a bad idea, that she wouldn't be able to go out in the sun, swim, or do anything that might cause an infection. But she wouldn't listen. I'm not sure how she can afford it, what with all the nights out, and her mum would kill her if she knew. JW said it would hurt like hell and showed her his tattoo, a little dagger someone did for him one night with a needle and a bottle of ink when there wasn't anything on the telly, apparently. But she wouldn't listen. Of course, she started crying as soon as the tattooist put his needle on her skin. She was shouting, "He's hurting me, Alex, make him stop!" So mortifying. She made so much fuss, the woman who had taken her money came through and told her she was frightening the other customers. She was smiling like it was a joke. They smile all the time here, especially when it is completely the wrong moment. And said there'd be no refund and told Rosie to basically sit still and shut up. She'd planned on having a big gecko on her shoulder, like Lars has, but I persuaded her to go for something smaller. She chose a rosebud in the end. It looked horrible when it was finished, all oozy and bloody. Gross. We came straight back to the guest house after, so Rosie could have a lie down. And I was helping her get her t-shirt over her shoulder so it didn't touch the wound, and something really weird happened. You know when you get that feeling someone's watching you? And I thought I saw something move where our curtains don't quite meet in the middle. It made me jump, and then Rosie screamed because I touched her arm. It spooked us both. Rosie made me go and look. I was really scared. I pulled the door open slowly. I kept thinking about that horror film we saw, Hostel. I was really shaking, but there was no one there. There had been, though, I'm sure. Rosie was more interested in taking some painkillers, but I got my emergency sewing kit out and sewed the curtains together. More soon. A. Kiss. Rosie was still playing her new tattoo to the hilt that night, wincing theatrically if anyone went near her and boring everyone to death with how much it hurt. It was like being stabbed, she told Mama, the only person in the guest house still willing to listen to her tale of woe. They should have warned me. Mama clucked and smiled as she inspected the wound. Poor Rosie, she murmured. I have something for this. Wads of cotton wool were brought from the back room, the mysterious area where Mama appeared to live. She hadn't been interested in Alex's report about a peeping Tom. Probably the fan blew the curtains, she'd said. This is a good guest house. No problems here. End of subject. I wonder if there's a Mr. Mama, Alex thought, watching the landlady swishing around in a caftan and high heels as big as small boats. Alex had made herself laugh out loud, and the nurse and patient wheeled round to glare. Shut up, Alex, I'm in pain here, Rosie said. Take this, dear, Mama said, putting a pill in her hand. This will make it better.
Chapter 20. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The Reporter. The doctor thought we were relatives. We hadn't said we were, but we'd screeched up to the hospital in our taxi, jumped out looking desperate, and the security people had ushered us through to an office immediately. Don and a grave-looking young doctor had a conversation in Thai, strings of words playing up and down the register that had ended with the doctor nodding and smiling sympathetically at Mick and me. "What have you told him?" I'd asked. But Don had shushed me and walked me out.
"Doesn't matter."
"Tell me."
"That you've flown out from England to see the fire survivor. He immediately assumed you were family."
"And you put him right?" "Don?" Don had winked at me and said,
"Shut up, you're in. Third floor, room 6. Doctor says you've got 5 minutes."
I'd stood, undecided, as people milled around us, until Mick had nudged me.
"Come on, Kate. We'll go and ask if he wants to see us. No harm in that."
I'd nodded and walked to the lift. And here we are, looking at an empty bed. Not just empty. The mattress has been stripped of sheets, ready for the next patient. Don goes outside to make sure we've got the right room and comes back in, shaking his head.
This is definitely room 6. I'll find a nurse.
When he comes back again, he looks grim.
He's gone. Discharged himself first thing. The nurse said there was nothing they could do to stop him.
While I was waiting for Mick, I fume silently. A name? An address?
No, she says it's confidential. She wanted to know who I was. I think she's going to find someone in charge. We might have to make a quick exit.
I thought you said you had a contact here.
I have. I've tried him, but he's on a ward round.
I want to scream. So close. If we'd been here a couple of hours earlier. I'm looking in the bedside locker for anything with a name on it, when the grave-looking doctor and a female colleague come in.
Hello, she says in English. I was looking after this patient, Mr. Waters.
It's Mrs. Waters, actually, I correct her. She looks puzzled. Sorry, not important, I say quickly.
Do you know where your patient has gone?
She shrugs.
No, the police might know. They came to talk to him. This morning he said he wanted to leave. He did not have money to stay.
Was he English?
Yes, Mr. Waters. He is English.
Mrs. Waters, I say again, trying not to show my irritation.
You are Mrs. Waters?
The doctor asks. Yes, yes. What else do you know about your patient? What is his name?
Mr. Waters,
she says. Look, I'm starting to feel as if I'm in some bizarre comedy sketch.
Are you saying his name is Mr. Waters?
Don interrupts.
Yes, the patient is Mr. Waters.
I feel like I'm stepping off a precipice.
First name?
I croak, but I already know. She pulls out a sheet of paper.
Jake.
Chapter 21. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The reporter.
What's going on? Do you know him?
Mick asks, his voice suddenly loud.
Kate?
It's my son,
I say, and sit down on the chair beside Jake's empty bed.
No! Stone me!
Mick says, pulling up another chair.
I can't believe it's him,
I say, and hear Mick muttering.
Fuck him right.
The female doctor and Don are discussing something in hushed voices.
Why did no one tell me?
I say.
Why was I not contacted after he came in?
He didn't want us to tell anyone, the doctor says. It was his right, Mrs. Waters.
Why? Why didn't he want us to know?
I shout into the empty air, and everyone starts moving towards me. Don helps me stand on unsteady legs.
Come on. We need to take you to the hotel. You've had a shock. Get her other arm, Mick.
Was he badly hurt? Was he burned?
I ask, shaking them off.
Not too badly, the doctor says. His injuries were not so serious. He has burns to his hands and some scorching on his right cheek and nose.
She is talking about the thickness and surface area of the burns, the rate of recovery. And I try to take it all in, but my mind keeps slipping back to an image of Jake trying to get out of the burning building. The panic he must have felt is roiling in my gut now. I want to hold him, to know he is safe now, but I can't. I pat the mattress he once lay on instead.
Does he know about the girls?
Don says to the doctor. And I suddenly remember why I'm here. She nods.
The police asked him about them when they came. But we don't know if he understood. He was in shock when he was admitted. He couldn't speak for the first 2 days, and he didn't mention them when he started to talk again. But all of this is completely understandable in the circumstances. I'm nodding, as if I too understand. But the facts keep slipping away from me.
And it was definitely Jake, I say.
She holds up the sheet of paper to show me. It has his date of birth, his passport number.
My boy.
Beside next of kin is written, not known.
I have to call Steve,
I say to Mick, and he signals to Dom to leave.
We'll get you some water,
he says, and I hear them talking as they walk away.
Bloody hell, you couldn't make it up,
Don is saying. I dial slowly, putting off the moment.
What am I going to tell him? What am I going to say? I don't know anything. Like why Jake was there in the hostel, or what he's been doing. What has he been up to for the last 2 years?
Steve picks up immediately.
Hello. You're early. Luckily, I've just woken up. What time is it there? How was the flight? The play was wonderful. I'll try to get more tickets for when you're back.
Steve, something's happened. It's Jake,
I blurt.
Jake? What? What's happened?
His voice is loud, spilling out of the phone into the room.
Are you in Phuket already? How is he? Can I speak to him?
I'm in a hospital in Bangkok. Jake was in the fire. The hostel fire I came out here to cover.
There is a beat of stunned silence as my husband wrestles with the news.
What?
He shouts.
I don't understand. What has Jake got to do with the fire?
He was there. I don't know why. The police have talked to him. They came to the hospital and questioned him.
Hospital? Police? Was he a witness?
I don't know.
Oh, Christ. Is he hurt?
The doctors say he's not in danger. They say he's got burns to his face and hands.
Haven't you seen him?
No, he's gone. Disappeared from the hospital.
Disappeared?
Yes, disappeared. I'm frightened for him, Steve.
I don't understand.
Nor do I. The doctor said he left after the police came. He didn't want us to know he was here. He asked the hospital not to contact us.
I'm crying too hard now to speak.
Take 3 deep breaths, my darling,
says Steve.
I need to be able to understand everything you're saying, and I need to see your face, Katie. FaceTime me so I can see you.
I hang up and close my eyes, taking slow, juddering breaths and letting the panic slide from my throat back into my stomach before FaceTiming Steve. I can see the strain in his face when he appears on the screen.
Now start again. From the beginning,
he says. And I do, as if I am filing a story to a copy taker in the old days.
New power, he said, colon, quote, 4.
And Steve is talking in his calm consultant's voice, telling me we'll find Jake and how skin recovers, telling me we'll bring him home as soon as possible, telling me everything is going to be all right. All the things I need to hear. And when we reach the end of the story, I say,
I'm sorry, Steve.
Why are you sorry?
He says. But he knows.
I lost him. Just like you said I would.
He sighs.
This isn't your fault. Go back to the hotel. We need to speak to the authorities. We need help to find him. But we will find him. Ring me when you get there, okay?
Okay. But nothing is okay. Everything has changed. Here, in this room that smells of bandages and antiseptic. I'm not the reporter here. I'm the mother.
Chapter 22. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The reporter. Don is making calls to the tourist police, and my ears prick every time I hear him say Jake's name. I wonder what he's telling them. Mick sits me down on a bench in reception, and I try to think, like a reporter. Where would an injured man with little money go? Would he check into the nearest hostel? Would he go to the embassy? Would he go to stay with friends? He'd need a pharmacy for painkillers. Did he have a prescription? I need to ask the doctor. She could alert the pharmacies. I write pharmacies on my notepad. My writing is shaky, and my mind wanders back to the empty bed.
Where are you?
I've been asking this question since the 1st of May, 2012, when Jake walked out of the house with his backpack and his hurt feelings. I should never have let it go on this long.
I need to do something, anything. I call Clive Barnes on the number on his business card. He is not happy to hear from me. There is nothing for the media at the moment, Miss Waters. You will have to wait. I'm a bit busy with the parents of the girls, so if you will excuse me... I interrupt his formal leave-taking and throw myself on his mercy. I tell him about Jake. His voice changes instantly to victim support mode, hiding any surprise and any secret triumph he must be feeling at Her Majesty's press being on the back foot.
I see,
he says simply.
You must be very worried. Please tell me his details, his date of birth, his passport number, if you know it. Give me a description of him, and let me see what I can do. Try not to worry too much.
He's following a script, I think, and try not to notice.
Can I ask if you've told the O'Connors or Shaws?
He says.
I understand you're talking to them regularly.
Not yet. I've only just found out myself.
I'll tell them. We don't want them to hear it from the media, do we?
A small moment of triumph, then. I would like to tell Leslie myself, I plead. I can answer her questions. I will be talking to her as a mother.
As you wish. I'll be in touch, Kate. And please let me know if Jake turns up.
Mick is tugging my arm.
They're here,
he hisses. Through the doors, I see the press pack clambering out of a convoy of taxis. They pour into the reception area and spot me immediately.
Bloody hell, she's got here first, I hear Louise say.
Mick tries to head them off.
Hi. Have you been to the site of the fire yet? What about the press conference?
He says.
Are the police saying anything yet? Not much coming out so far,
George says.
We've heard the guest house was known as a good place to get drugs. Everyone's waiting on the IDs and the PMs, so we're all filing colour from the scene and interviewing the same stoned backpackers.
I try to laugh with the rest of them, but it feels fake.
Never mind that. Have you spoken to the boy who survived?
Louise calls across to me. She's not the sort to be distracted.
No,
I say, and my voice trembles. Louise looks at me hard, and the reporters come closer.
You look upset, George says. What's happened? Has there been a row? Are you being chucked out?
No, I say. Nothing like that. I take a deep breath and think about keeping quiet. But they're going to find out anyway. I would.
The thing is, the survivor is my son, Jake.
You're joking. Your son,
George says, and there is a buzz of excitement among the reporters.
Yes, I know. Unbelievable. I didn't realise until I spoke to the doctor.
Wow,
Louise says, and I see her scribble something in her notebook.
I knew he was in Thailand. I told you, George. But I thought he was in Phuket, saving turtles,
I say, trying to explain but sounding hopeless.
God, that must have been such a shock. How is he, Kate?
George asks.
Not too bad, the doctor says. Some burns to his hands and face.
I feel like I'm talking to my friends. They are my friends, most of them. But more of them are taking down what I'm saying. Is this a press conference?
How old is Jake?
Someone asks.
So is he on holiday?
How did he get out of the fire?
Did he get his burns trying to save the girls?
Is he a hero, Kate?
And while I'm struggling to find answers, Louise says,
You'll get us in to see him, won't you?
The reporters go quiet. I swallow hard.
No, I can't. Jake isn't here anymore.
Where is he, then? Have you squirreled him away in a hotel?
Louise snaps.
No, I haven't. I haven't even seen him. He discharged himself this morning before I got here. I don't know where he is.
What? He's disappeared,
she says, and everyone crowds close around me so they don't miss a word.
Do the police know?
A TV reporter asks from behind his video camera, and I nod.
They talked to him last night.
So is he a hero or a suspect?
Louise says.
Shut up, Louise,
George says.
Ignore her, Kate.
I look at them, at the faces I know so well. They are people I have been scared with,
laughed with, confided in, got drunk with. But suddenly I am the stranger in their midst. I am the story.
Part 2. The Story.
Chapter 23. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The Mother. She turned on Malcolm as soon as the hotel bedroom door closed.
Why didn't you back me up, sitting there not saying a word? There was nothing I could say, Leslie. You and Jenny asked all the questions, and the police know what they're doing. Who says? I saw that embassy bloke roll his eyes when the policeman was talking. I want to know what happened to my daughter. Our daughter. Yes, yes, our daughter. That's what I want, too. You know that. We mustn't let this push us apart, love. It's what happens to couples when something terrible happens. They turn on each other, blame each other. I've read about it in the papers. We're not like Jenny and Mike, Leslie snapped.
Being reasonable was not what she wanted at that moment. She was so angry she felt she could burst. Her daughter was lying in a morgue, and no one could tell her why. Why was Alex dead? Who was to blame? Malcolm got into bed, fully clothed, exhausted, and closed his eyes.
We can't sleep now, Leslie shouted, startling him. We've got to find out who is responsible for this. Get up!
Malcolm turned onto his back and looked at the ceiling, tears rolling into his hair.
Stop being so passive, Leslie shrieked.
He reached out his arms to her and she collapsed onto the bed, folding herself into him.
We will find out.
He stroked her hair and stilled her clenching fists.
But we can't function without sleep, love. You're so tired you can't see straight. Close your eyes just for half an hour.
She waited for him to fall asleep, monitoring his breathing as it slowed, then rose and sat at the desk with the flimsy notepad she'd found on the bedside table. She wrote things to do, just like she would if she'd been at home. But instead of writing phone bank, buy cat food, dry cleaning, she put find out how the fire started, who else was in the hostel, was there a party, where were Alex and Rosie? Why didn't they get out? She was gripping the cheap hotel biro so hard it splintered. When she looked up from the list, she saw her hollow-eyed reflection in the mirror.
Why didn't you get out, Alex? She said.
But the bereaved mother looking back at her had no answers. The phone rang, and she picked it up quickly to avoid it waking Malcolm.
Mrs. O'Connor? A sweet voice sang to her from reception. I have someone here to see you. Please hold.
Leslie, it's Kate. I hope I haven't woken you. Can I come up?
Okay, but Malcolm's asleep.
Kate looked terrible when Leslie opened the door. Her makeup was all smudged as if she'd been crying. What's she got to cry about? Flitted through Leslie's head, but she didn't ask. She couldn't summon the energy.
We'll have to talk in the bathroom,
she whispered, and led the way. She sat down on the toilet lid, and Kate perched on the side of the bath.
We've identified the girls. It is them, Leslie said in one breath. I'd hoped they'd made a mistake, but it is Alex and Rosie.
I'm so sorry, Leslie.
Yes, well, now we have to find out what happened.
She knew she sounded manic, but she had to keep going or she would break down. Keep strong. She told herself, kneading her thigh with her fist to keep herself focused. Of course, Kate said. What are the police saying?
That there was a party that night, that there were drugs and drink, that it was most probably an accident. That's what the interpreter told us. A candle or something like that.
Right, Kate said. Was there evidence of a candle causing the fire?
I don't know. They didn't say. The thing is, there are no witnesses, according to the police. It just doesn't make sense.
Right, Kate repeated.
Why does she keep saying that, as if she doesn't believe me?
But Clive Barnes says he's heard about the boy you mentioned at the airport, the boy who got out alive. I want to talk to him and find out why my daughter didn't.
There was a silence that filled the bathroom. Another tiled room, Leslie thought, and tore several sheets of toilet paper off the roll to wipe her eyes.
Kate looked as upset as she was, and she passed her another piece of loo roll. "Sorry, Leslie, I'm a bit all over the place. When did Clive tell you this? Did he have a name?" "No, why? Do you know who it is? Have you seen him?" Leslie asked. "It's my son." "What? What are you talking about?" Leslie felt completely lost, as if she'd blacked out and come to at a different point in the conversation. Kate leaned forward to tell her, nearly falling off the narrow lip of the bath. Leslie put out her hand to steady her. "Careful," she said, but Kate brushed her away. "I went to the hospital to try to speak to the survivor, and when I got to the room, I discovered it was my son, Jake. The doctors told me. I didn't even know he was in Bangkok. We thought he was in Phuket. That's what he always told us. It was a complete shock." "Your son?" "Yes, Jake." "Was in the fire?" "Yes, I know it must be hard for you to take in. It was for me." Leslie couldn't speak for a moment as she tried to make sense of it. "What does he say happened?" she said. "Apparently he couldn't tell the police anything when they spoke to him."
"Yes, that's what the policeman said to us, too. But he'll be able to tell us what happened, won't he?"
"Not at the moment."
"Well, when can we go and see him?"
Leslie jumped up, adrenaline surging through her, flung open the bathroom door and shouted Malcolm's name.
"What?"
he groaned. "Alex?"
"Wake up, love. We're going to the hospital. We're going now," she said.
Nothing was going to stop her. Kate took hold of her arm in an attempt to restrain her, but Leslie shook her off impatiently.
"Come on, Kate, you can take us."
But there was something wrong. Hers was the only energy in the room. Kate looked flat and panicky.
"Hold on, Leslie. The thing is, I don't know where he is now." "No one does. He left the hospital this morning."
"Why? Has he run away?"
Kate couldn't look her in the eye.
"Well, has he?"
"No," Kate said loudly. "He told the doctor he didn't have enough money to pay big medical bills."
"Didn't he call you to say he was in hospital?"
Silence again. "No. He hadn't been in touch properly for a while. He came to Thailand to find himself. Sorry, you don't want to hear about my family problems. Look, there's no point coming to the hospital. Honestly, he's gone."
"What are you talking about?" Malcolm said,
his head still on the pillow, his voice deadened by exhaustion.
"Go back to sleep, love,"
Leslie said. She would deal with this.
"What are you doing to find him?"
she asked. "Everything I can, but I need your help. We're talking to different people, Leslie, but we can pool our information. Will you let me know as soon as you hear anything?" Her turn for silence.
"And will you publish what I tell you?"
"No, not now." The answer was too quick, but Kate decided to go with it. "I want to find my son."
"Okay. We're talking to Clive later, and we're going to do a press conference in the morning. We want to talk to the media."
"There'll be lots of questions about drugs, Leslie. You do know that."
"She didn't take drugs."
"No, but the police and local press may be telling a different story. Just be prepared."
"And what about you? You'll have to be prepared for questions about your son, won't you? We'll be in the same boat."
Bangkok, day 13. Friday, the 8th of August, 2014. From Alex O'Connor to Max Harding. Subject: Nightmare continues. "Hi, Max. Still waiting to set off for the next stop. We've already been here a week longer than we said, but R is being a complete bitch and won't talk about it. Went up to our room today and walked in on her and Lars. So embarrassing. Rosie shouted at me to get out. I mean, it's my room too. Lars came out still putting on his shirt and said sorry. Rosie pretended nothing had happened when I went in. She's weird like that. She said Lars was taking her to another club tonight. He's going to do some DJing. He calls himself DJ Rappo. Crappo, more like. I think he's taken some of my stuff. Well, someone must be. I keep losing things. Those earrings I bought for school prom have gone. Rosie and I had a row about it. She says I leave stuff all over the place, but I don't. I'm not imagining it. I'm so desperate to leave. I'm seriously thinking about ditching Rosie and travelling solo. But it's too scary. I wouldn't want to stay in a place like this on my own. There are weird people coming and going all the time, and the locks don't work properly. Maybe it's better to wait. The Dutch boys are going to Myanmar by bus on Monday, so she won't have anyone to play with after that. And I keep thinking maybe things will be different when we get on the road and it's just us. Maybe it'll be all right then. I'm keeping busy, reading and people watching. There are so many visitors. Mama takes them three to the back, but they're not staying here. Sometimes they have a coffee or a beer at the bar. Sometimes they just drift off. Lots to look at anyway. And there's a mystery English bloke here who I've seen a couple of times. He doesn't speak to us, sits smoking dope out of the window under the sign that says no drugs here. The boys he shares the dorm with call him the stoner. But there's something about him. He's older than us and interesting. I know that doesn't sound sexy, but he is in a funny kind of way. Going to have breakfast. Back soon. Part 2. Turns out the mystery bloke isn't another traveller. He works here to pay for his keep, cleaning the showers and making the breakfasts. He's normally finished by the time I get back from my walk, but I didn't go this morning, too busy writing to you. Anyway, he just spoke to me. I was sitting at the bar and the Dutch boys were at the other end, talking about a drinking game they'd been playing last night. They still managed to eat a huge omelette with chilies, some sort of meat, and what looked like clots of tomato sauce. Gross. Finished, he said when he picked up the plates, and he put his thumb in the tomato sauce smears. We got chatting about the terrible food. He said he knows how bad it is because he used to eat it too. He's got a lovely smile. And he said he'd show me a better place up the road. He says there are fewer cockroaches, and it's cheaper. Win-win. Wish me luck. A. Kiss. Afterwards, she realised she hadn't even asked his name. One of the Dutch boys told her he was called Jake.
Chapter 24. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The Reporter. I ring Terry from my room, repeating the facts about Jake as I know them, numb now to the consternation my story causes.
So he's a hero, then?
Terry asks uncertainly. Possibly, I say, willing it to be true.
File what you've got, and I'll get Joe to pull it together in the office. There's some nice stuff from family members we can weave in. What are you going to do next?
Not sure, to be honest. Don is putting out feelers to contacts, but it's a needle in a haystack job. He could be anywhere. For the first time in my career, I don't know where to begin. I normally love the hunt for the story, but this time it's personal. Everything matters desperately, and I'm afraid of what I'll find.
You get on with it, then,
Terry is saying,
and stay in touch.
I lie back on the bed. Just for 5 minutes, I tell myself, before I have to act. I close my eyes to try to stop the chaos in my head. Ideas, thoughts, images, fears. I think about that time Jake jumped off the shed roof. He just sat there, holding his wrist like it didn't belong to him. Pale but composed. It's probably broken, he said. It was Freddy who'd cried. My brave boy, I'd told Jake over and over as we waited in A&E for an X-ray. It came out later that he'd been trying to get his little brother to jump when he fell. But we let it go. He had a broken wrist after all. I wonder what else we let go. My dad used to say we spoiled him. We argued about it. Horrible word, spoil. Sounds so childish. But it means harm or destroy. I lie there thinking, did we? Did we spoil our son? Everything is running at twice normal speed. Slow down, I tell myself out loud. This is good news. He's alive. His injuries are not serious. He probably tried to save the girls. But there is a voice in my head asking, so why has he vanished? I sit up and start typing. Write it and then hit the phone, I tell myself. The next time I ring in, Terry tells me the story is the splash, a spread on pages 4 and 5, and there's a column by an MP who lost a child abroad. And Jake? I ask.
Three pairs in the lead about him getting out alive and his injuries. Okay? One of the tabloids is ramping it up into full-blown hero stuff. They've got a photo of Jake from somewhere.
A photo?
From your local paper, looks like. I didn't know he got a special prize for his A-level results. That you'd produce a genius.
Yes. I remember the reporter and photographer turning up, and Jake pretending not to be impressed. I'm so proud of you, I'd told him, kissing his cheek and wiping off the lipstick smudge. I'd watched as he posed for the camera. My confident, clever boy.
Now go to bed and get some sleep,
Terry says, hauling me back into the nightmare.
Sure, I say, but I have no intention of doing so. I need to know everything that is going on. Need to get a grip.
Is Joe in the office? I just want to touch base, I say.
Yes, the golden child is sitting watching Countdown with the rest of the kindergarten. I'll get him to ring you now. Hi, Kate,
Joe says when I pick up his call.
How's it going? Any word on Jake?
Not yet. Anything your end? Joe rattles off the people he's spoken to, but it's all background noise. They were such lovely girls, seems to be the sum of his efforts. But it allows me to slip back into reporter mode, just for a minute. Keep in touch with all of them, I say. We want to hear anything they're hearing.
Yes, Kate.
By the way, bet you lost in the conundrum round.
What?
Terry grassed you up. And Joe?
Yes, Kate?
Daytime telly is for losers.
Yes, Kate.
Chapter 25. Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. The reporter. I go back to Cowson Road as soon as I hang up, telling myself I need to get some sense of what happened there. I'm scouring the crowd for my son. He's not here, and the faces start to blur as I stare too hard, desperate for the familiar. People stare back and I start showing them the photo of Jake I have on my phone. It's a picture of him smiling at someone off to the side. Maybe me. I can't remember now. It has been my screensaver for 2 years, and I can't even recall the occasion. They all smile in sympathy and shake their heads, but I know they're not really looking. They're not taking him in. They need to remember his face. I go into a copy shop to get Jake's photo made into flyers. On the bottom, I have printed his name, my phone number, and please help me find Jake. Like a woman in a story. Then I thread through the throng, handing them out. Kids take them, perhaps thinking it's a voucher for a free drink or entry to a club. I see them glance down, then stuff them in their pockets or drop them as they walk away. Why would they care? I go and sit in the front row of tables at one of the bars, as far away from the loudspeakers as possible, but the disco music batters my skull like hail. I watch as herds of new arrivals parade past. Girls in shorts, flashing white thighs and big earrings. They've clearly heard a good time is to be had here, and their faces show their determination to have it. Their screams of laughter echo round the bars, fighting with the music for my ears. The boys are skinny kids by comparison, clutching bottles of beer, jostling each other, egging each other on with shoves and winks as the pretty restaurant fluffers pretend to tug down their tiny skirts, but hitch them up further instead. Planet good time, I think. But a glance round the neighbouring tables tells a different story. Blank, exhausted faces, busy anaesthetising themselves with plastic buckets of vodka and Red Bull, or outsized bottles of Chang beer. Bored-looking couples are staring intently at phones, not each other. A lone boy is warily eyeing the massage chairs in the shop opposite. The masseuses, with young bodies and old faces, are lounging on the wipeable upholstery, like lizards waiting to pounce. Later, that boy is probably thinking. After a couple more beers, if I don't get lucky. It all feels tired and cheap, like Blackpool with good weather, I think. Gin and tonic, I shout to the hovering bar boy. His face doesn't register the request, but he returns with the drink and the bill. I show him Jake's flyer,
and he shrugs and points behind him. On the posts holding up the awning are taped a dozen photocopied pictures, each with its own heartfelt plea from a friend or parent. I take a big mouthful of my drink, welcoming the bitterness and buzz.
"On your own?" says a voice from behind me.
When I look round, I see Louise, sitting two tables away. "Yes," I say, and turn back to my glass. I can't face her. The inevitable fake concern, the sly questions. She comes over and sits down in the chair beside me.
"I know this must be a very difficult time," she says, and I laugh.
"Bloody hell, Louise. Are you really going to try that on me?" She shuts up.
"Another gin and tonic,"
she calls across to the waiter.
"Sorry, old habits and all that. How are you doing?"
"Been better. Look, I really don't feel like talking. Why aren't you having dinner with the rest of the pack?"
"Don't fancy it. They're getting rat-arsed in the hotel bar. Have you eaten?"
"I haven't. Not since I arrived a lifetime ago. And the gin is beginning to make my head spin." But she doesn't wait for an answer.
"I'm going to get a bowl of something here," Louise says. "I'll order one for you, too. You need to eat. Keep your strength up."
She's doing a me, I think, and almost smile in recognition. Mothering me. Taking control. I want to tell her where to shove her bowl of food, but it feels so nice to be looked after like this. Not to have to make any decisions. So I let her carry on. And I eat the sticky, sweet chicken and rice, as if I haven't had food for days. As I finish, Louise puts down her bowl, even though it's still half full. Can't ask questions if you've got your mouth full, I think, marking her performance.
"Have you any idea where Jake might have gone?" she says. "He must be so traumatized by what happened."
I don't reply. I wait her out. But she is doing the same. We sit in silence as she fusses with her serviette, then wets her finger and tries to pick up stray rice grains from the table.
"What have you written?"
I ask, the first to weaken.
"The girls, the mums, the holiday of a lifetime, the usual. And I've written Jacob as the reluctant hero, who risked all to try to save the girls and then slipped away to avoid the limelight."
"Right. I hear you got a photo of him."
"Yeah, the local news agency found it. I think everyone has it. Nice pic, but a bit old. I expect he looks a bit different now."
"Yes," I say, "but I have no idea. I tried to picture him with a beard or a shaven head."
"When did you last see him?"
Louise asks casually, beckoning the waiter to order more drinks.
"Not for me, thanks," I say quickly. "I need to go back to the hotel."
I dig for my purse to pay, but Louise waves it away.
"I'll get this. It's on expenses anyway."
And she picks up the flyer I've pulled out with my wallet.
"This is a good idea," she says. "Mind if I keep it?"
Later, back in my room, I scroll through the news websites and see my flyer with the headline, "Mother's Desperate Hunt for Hero Son." It's me. I start to dial Louise's mobile and stop. Everything I say now will be news. I need to say nothing. Chapter 26. Wednesday, the 20th of August, 2014. The Reporter. Terry is struggling to say the right thing. He can never get it right, and I've often wondered how he ever managed as a reporter on the road.
"Look, Kate, this is a big story, but I can't have you filing developments if you're part of it. You do see, don't you?"
"I do, but I feel a door closing."
"Well, just for a couple of days, until I sort out Jake," I tried to push back. "I make it sound like it's nothing, like I'm dealing with a child having a tantrum."
"Yes, but what if things get difficult?"
he says.
"Difficult?"
I snap. But we both know what he means.
"You know how things can get," Terry says wearily. "I don't need to tell you."
He doesn't. Perhaps it's started already.
"What's being said about Jake, then?"
Not much, and it's all pretty positive. He's being portrayed as the survivor who may hold the key to what happened.
Well, that sounds okay, I say hopefully.
I hope you've told Steve not to say anything.
I haven't, but I will now. And Freddy.
Anyway, you need to concentrate on your family,
he adds. The last nail in the coffin. When the news desk starts talking about your family, you know it's over. Has this come from the editor? I ask. Terry doesn't answer immediately, but of course it has. I'm being cut adrift in case my son and I damage his paper's precious reputation.
Simon is very concerned about what you must be going through, Kate,
Terry says finally.
He's got kids too. He feels you need to focus on Jake. We all do.
So who's going to cover the story here for us? Don?
I'm sending Joe out.
Right. Well, he'll be pleased to get his first big foreign. When is he arriving?
He's on his way. He'll ring you when he gets in tomorrow. God, it must be tomorrow already there. Go to bed, Kate. Oh, and let me know if there's anything I can do to help. Okay?
He's desperate to get off the phone and end his attempt to feel my pain. Okay, I say. I look at the time on the television display. It's 2 a.m. I pick up my notebook and reread my list. Hospitals, pharmacies, turtle sanctuaries. When I ring home, I get my answer phone announcement and start speaking over myself, telling Steve to pick up.
Kate, sorry about that. I've had to start screening calls. All your lot keep ringing to ask about Jake. Is there any news?
No, not yet. I've been handing out flyers around the guest house.
I should be there with you.
I'm fine, I lie. Let's see what happens in the next day or so. I think he'll turn up when he sees the coverage, and then I'll bring him home.
God, I hope so. Freddy says he's getting friend requests from reporters on his Facebook page.
How is he doing? I'll ring him now.
He's okay, a bit confused, like we all are.
I know. Look, I know I don't need to say it, but don't talk to the reporters, even the ones you know, especially not them.
Why do you think I'm screening calls? Never mind them. What are the police saying?